People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. This is Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note here on Fine Music Radio. It's always a great pleasure and an honor to have a real live composer in this classical world in the studio with me. And sometimes when you say a live classical composer, people think, oh dear, what are we in for now? And I can assure you, you're in for some interesting talk, because Hendrik Hofmeyr, the composer, is here with me. He's been called South Africa's most performed composer by the chair of SAMRO, no less, and was referred to in an article in Musicus as probably the most commissioned composer living in South Africa. He was born in Cape Town and matriculated at Nassau High School in Mowbray. He got 7 first classes, finishing among the top 3 candidates in the Cape Province. Then he enrolled for a Bachelor of Music degree at the College of Music at the University of Cape Town and studied under Laura Searle, among other people. After completing the Master of Music degree in piano performing at the University of Cape Town, he left for Italy on an overseas scholarship in 1981. And during 10 years of self-imposed exile as a conscientious objector, he studied piano in Florence, Bologna, and also conducting in Florence. And he returned to South Africa in 1992. Hendrik, there's lots we can talk about, but a warm welcome to Fine Music Radio and to People of Note.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here.
I hope you know that one of the tricks of radio is attracting an audience all the time. Mm-hmm. And I know that you said getting music performed on radio, let alone in concerts for modern composers, is always tricky. But I think we play a fair amount of your music, do you think?
Indeed, yes. No, I'm very grateful for that. I think also on behalf of all the other South African composers that you do play, I think you are doing a wonderful service to the music industry in this country, and one that I'm afraid very few other broadcasters feel any need to do so. Thank
right.
you for that.
Oh, good. Well, that gets you into our good books immediately, saying that. But do you know if your music is broadcast internationally as well on other radio stations out of South Africa?
It does happen occasionally. It's not that regular. I think mainly because, you know, a South African composer doesn't have that huge infrastructure that drives publicity and exposure that you get overseas, where I think there is still money to be made out of classical composers. In this mm-hmm. country, unfortunately, there is no industry and therefore no agents really, and no one kind of putting you out there where people can notice you. So as an African composer, I'm dependent mostly on the goodwill of performers who might like the music and take it further, and who, when they get exposure overseas, will take a work with him. So I had, for example, a Bulgarian soprano, Mirjana Gurova, who won quite a big competition in Europe and then was broadcast on 9 or 10 national radio stations, and she fortunately did a song cycle of mine, so my music kind of went along for the ride.
Excellent. But now that's an interesting thing. You say you don't have the infrastructure here. So are most of your works then commissioned locally? Or
yes.
How does it work? Or do you, I mean, obviously there's the inspiration, the creative mm-hmm. side, but there's got to be money to pay the rent.
Look, I speak under correction, but I don't know of any composer living in this country who makes a living simply out of writing classical music. Perhaps if you write for the movies or television, you do have a chance. But yes, there's simply not that much money in classical music. I have been very fortunate in the number of commissions I've received. And in a way, I always say to people say to me, you know, you get a commission and then you have to write something. And what if you don't feel inspired? And I always say, well, the commission itself for me is inspiration. It's so wonderful to be appreciated and to have people who want to play music by you. And of course, the person for whom the work is commissioned has a style of playing, a personality, and the instrument that they play has a personality and certain things about it that you might, as a composer, want to exploit and highlight. And all those things are, for me, really inspiring. It's wonderful to write for specific instruments and specific people and specific orchestras. From that point of view, I think I've been quite privileged, because I don't think there is that much going round in terms of commissions and activity in this country. So can't complain.
No. As I said, you've been called South Africa's most performed composer and one of the most commissioned composers living around. And that was an interesting thing you said when someone said, well, what if you don't feel like it? But I suppose also if you know an artist and you know their style and their temperament, that helps to inspire you as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. That for me is really the point of departure. Sometimes it's the instrument. For example, if you're writing for, let's say, the clarinet and you particularly love the low register or the cantabile or the agility, obviously you want to incorporate all the facets of the personality of the instrument also into the piece. So yes, it's a combination of the personality of the instrument and the personality of the player.
I got to know your flute concerto quite well through Helen Fossler and the recording that she made of it. Mm-hmm. And it occurred to me now with you just saying this, that obviously you know Helen and her sound and her style and even her humor and her character. Is it fair to say you wrote it for her in
mind? Absolutely, absolutely, with her in mind. And, you know, I think also putting on show, you know, those things that she is particularly good at, her very strong low register, you might recall the slow movement, sits very low, I think it's quite daunting for your average flautist, but of course she plays it magnificently.
I used to play the flute years and years ago. So I don't even say I play the flute anymore, but I did. And I remember how on the flute the low register is very tricky, and I always remember Helen's magnificent low register. So there you are, you see.
Yes, I always think it's almost like a bronze-like quality that she obtains in that low register. Quite unique.
Now look, before we go any further, Hendrik, I want to hear some of your music. And one of the pieces that kept cropping up when I was reading about you was a work called Raptus. And it seems as though that put you on the map. Just tell us a little bit of background before we listen to a snatch of that work.
Yes, I came back to South Africa more or less as an unknown quantity. I'd left as a musicologist and pianist and kind of came back as a composer. I had by that stage won a competition for film music in Italy and an opera competition in South Africa, but I still had to kind of prove myself. And I decided, after I started teaching at the University of Stellenbosch, to enter a couple of international competitions just to try and get my name more established. Also, of course, get overseas performances, which are always valuable. And I wrote this piece for the Queen Elizabeth competition, which, as I'm sure you know, is, I think they say it's the world's oldest music competition, a very prestigious competition. But primarily a competition for violinists in the first place. And of course, nowadays they alternate with pianists and so forth. But yes, this was for the violin competition. And part of the competition is that they have to play in the final round, the 12 finalists, a new work for violin and orchestra, which they have to study completely on their own. They get locked in a kind of castle in the forest. It's all quite medieval, and they have guards to make sure that they get no input from everyone, and they do not know who the composer is, but that composer, in fact, is the person who won the composition section of the competition. And yeah, I was very thrilled when I got the rather mysterious and cryptic telegrams in those days, because I was also not allowed to tell anyone that I'd won the competition at that stage.
Good grief.
Until I was flown out to Brussels for the final round on the eve of the first performance. There was a press conference and I was introduced to the 12 violinists, and then they had two per evening for the next 6 days. And yes, I must say, magnificent exposure. I don't think there's any other competition that matches this, because you have the 12 live performances, all of them broadcast, all of them televised, and all of them broadcast and televised in relay the next day as well. So you have 60 performances all in all throughout Europe, and that really is magnificent in terms of exposure. Usually you're very lucky to get one kind of national performance. If you
well done to you. No wonder it put you on the map, Raptus. Okay, so you say it's about 12 minutes long, so we can't take the whole piece. Uh-huh. So shall we start at the beginning and any little guide to listen?
I think the title might be a little bit mysterious to some people. It means a state of transcendental rapture, and it's something that the sound of the solo violin, especially in its high register against the orchestra, has often suscitated in me. And I think it's been exploited by a great number of composers as well, these kind of moments of almost an ecstatic,
like
meditation.
Like Vaughan Williams, Lark
Absolutely. Or I think the most direct inspiration, perhaps the violin concerto of Szymanowski, who was always been a great influence in my writing and my thinking. So yes, I suppose it's more or less a direct homage to Szymanowski, although I don't think it sounds like it was written by Szymanowski, but yes, the aesthetic point of departure is certainly a very similar one.
Okay, so here is the first, 3 or 4 or 5 minutes of Raptus, composed by my guest, Hendrik Hofmeyr. There, unfortunately, we have to leave that work called Raptus for Violin and Orchestra, composed by my guest on People of Note here on Fine Music Radio this week, Hendrik Hofmeyr. And just tell me a little bit about it, because that also sounded like a rather strange cadenza there. It sounded at one stage as though he was tuning, plucking the strings
indeed.
Like that.
Yes, indeed. Fiendishly difficult cadenza, and one that I had to construct very carefully, as the secrecy of the competition meant I had to work it all out myself and couldn't really ask a violinist to play it for me and see whether it was feasible. So I had to make sure it was feasible before I got to Brussels, because they will have been practicing it for a week by then. And yes, one of the hard things about it is in the middle of the cadenza, they actually have to retune a string which they had tuned up a semitone just before the cadenza to the right pitch. And they can repeat it a few times pizzicato to make sure it's right. But of course, There's always the danger that the tuning peg might actually slip and the string come loose completely. So they all said they were praying that this was not going to happen.
Why did you do that to them, Hendrik?
Well, fortunately, none of them had a slip. So I'm very happy that it all worked out.
But the other thing that struck me there was the orchestra sounded quite sort of solid, quite big. Was it scored for a fairly large orchestra?
Not particularly. I would say what normally, I suppose nowadays, we'd call a fairly smallish orchestra, really a classical size with double woodwind. But yes, I do like to use the instruments in the orchestra individually, which generates often, I suppose, fairly variegated and dense. I would not say necessarily. I try to not make it sound too dense, but just almost like a kaleidoscope of changing colors. Mm-hmm. And again, there I think the influence of Szymanowski is very apparent. It's one of the aspects of his orchestration that I greatly admire. And of course, I don't like writing a concerto in which you have the soloist, as Busoni said, rather like the ringmaster, and the orchestra like the tame lion, making a few noises in the background. I like to engage the orchestra as well.
Okay. Well, that was interesting to hear Raptus. And who was performing there?
That was the British violinist Andrew Haveron. He came fourth overall, but I liked his performance of this particular piece best, and I selected this one for the official CD that came out after the competition.
Okay. Now, before we get to your next piece of music, which is going to be a different genre, I have noticed, everyone notices that you write in a number of different genres, solo piano, string quartet, voice and string quartet, full orchestra, opera, a symphony apparently you're working on at the moment. So what genre do you feel most happy in?
Oh, I would have a very hard job choosing. I love all of them. I would say that I probably am predisposed to vocal music. I would say at least half of my oeuvre is vocal. So yes, I love the voice. I grew up in a house where, especially Lieder, were constantly on the turntable. So love the voice. Going to Italy, of course, also opened my eyes and my ears to Italian opera. Before that, I was mostly, I sort of made a leap from Mozart to Wagner and tended to be a bit snobbish, as young intellectual students will be about the Italian school. But yes, I discovered Italian opera in Italy and love the way they treat the voice. I think no one else treats it better. And I've tried to incorporate that understanding of the voice also into my own writing. I, of course, also in Italy, earned my bread as a vocal coach. So that was kind of first-hand exposure to what makes Italian vocality tick.
Were you at any point a singer?
I studied a bit of singing in Italy also, yes. Okay. But again, really just to understand the voice better.
And you spoke about the Italians knowing how to use the voice, but you also mentioned in your phrase Wagner, and everyone knows that I'm a huge Wagner fanatic. I was thrilled to discover that you are such an expert on the Ring Cycle. Maybe one day we can do an entirely different program on that.
Oh, that would be wonderful.
But what about Wagner's writing for the voice, which some people say can be very damaging, although it's to do with technique. We hear Jonas Kaufmann singing Wagner magnificently and also doing the Italian style. Do you think Wagner was unkind to the voice?
I think Wagner was definitely less kind to the voice than the Italians. But,
very diplomatic answer.
But I think you observed very nicely that Jonas Kaufmann also sings Italian. And I think if you sing Wagner with a more Italianate vocality, you, first of all, don't damage your voice. And secondly, it's sounds so much better. You know, so also someone like Placido Domingo, when he sings Wagner, it just makes Wagner sound so much kinder to the voice than he normally does, doesn't it?
true. It's interesting that you said that about Kaufmann, who's very much the tenor of the moment, but's been suffering from vocal problems. But I think of him as a Wagner singer who also sings Italian in a sort of Wagnerian way. So it's almost as I had a different approach to you. So I'm going to have to rethink that now.
Well, I think he's a hybrid. There are definitely aspects of his vocality which are clearly German, but I think he's managed to incorporate enough Italian vocality to save him from being a typical example of a German school.
Of a Helden tenor, yes. But then, talking about opera, your opera, The Fall of the House of Usher, was also one of the sort of great cornerstones of your life, wasn't it? Just tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that was when I was still in Italy full time, and I heard about the competition for a new one-act chamber opera. Entered it and was, again, very thrilled to be put through each of the successive rounds. It was a strangely structured competition. You had to first submit an aria and then a synopsis and a libretto and then the beginning of all the arias, and only after that the opera as a whole. But I felt I would be on solid ground, because I do believe that opera needs arias. I don't believe in the kind of modern kitchen sink version of opera where, you know, everyone prattles about pots and pans for half an hour and then it's over. So the fact that they were looking for arias made me think I was onto a good thing. And Emma Renzi, who was head of the panel, then contacted me at a certain point, you know, asked more about me, and we became very firm friends after that also. And of course, the work was then produced at the State Theatre as part of the prize. And I believe it was Johan Botha's debut as a professional singer.
Oh, really?
One of the tenor roles in the work.
Is it a vast work? I don't know it at all.
No, it's the time limit was 45 minutes.
Oh, so for the whole opera?
For the whole opera. So it's only 45 minutes long, which was quite a challenge, condensing the story into 45 minutes. But yeah, it was a short story originally, of course, so it's not really that lengthy history to get through. And it is really a work of atmosphere and mood and tensions and all those things that I like putting into music. So it was great fun to write.
One of the things I want to ask you just after our next piece of music is more about the way you compose, your inspiration in all these different genres we've spoken about, and the things you've said about tension and using the orchestra with a concerto, using the voice. But a string quartet, I see, is next on the list, which is quite different from what we've just heard. So, but it's also different in a way that it's not exactly a string quartet. Tell us what we're going to hear.
Indeed, it's a song cycle for soprano and string quartet called Of Darkness and the Heart, on four poems by Cape Town poet Fiona Zerbst. The poems deal with her experiences in Russia. She had a sojourn in Russia and had a rather dark and tempestuous love relationship there. And these poems were the result of that. The piece we're going to listen to is actually what I envisaged as a kind of Russian tango of the rather dark and sardonic kind. Kind of maybe someone like Shostakovich might come up with.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Because the text itself is rather dark and sardonic, as you'll hear. The work actually originated as a cycle for soprano and orchestra, commissioned by the Goethe Institute, who'd commissioned several composers and poets to put together works for voice and orchestra. We were thrown together on a private game reserve, four composers and four poets, and rather like on Love Boat, I suppose we were supposed to mate during the weekend.
Oh,
and fortunately, Fiona was there, because I must say I liked her poetry far better than any of the others, and fortunately she liked my music better than the others, so we formed a couple and we came up with this work. And yes, it was a wonderful privilege to set the poetry. I think poetry very much suited to music, and I'm rather fussy about what poems I do choose. So the work was premiered then as part of this program in Pretoria when the NAPOP Orchestra was still in existence. Of course, getting works for voice and orchestra performed is, again, rather tricky in this country, so I decided to make a version for voice and string quartet, which has been performed quite a few times since then and is, in fact, also included on the string quartet CD that I produced a few years ago.
Tables and that world falls from what we always do. If I'd gone away with you, if I'd gone away with you, I would have this image clear of your skin, your smile, the clear picture of a future.
Voice and string quartet. Who'd have thought, as they say? Tell us a little bit about that, Hendrik Hofmeyr, my guest on People of Note, and who wrote that, the composer.
Well, let me first of all say that was Sabina Mosloff singing with the Odeon String Quartet from Bloemfontein, the only resident string quartet at a South African university. And they approached me about making a CD of my string quartets, and of course I was only too willing to oblige.
Of course, with a little touch of ragtime there, as you said. But now the CD that you have here, the title track is Of Darkness and the Heart, which is what we've heard an excerpt from. But how many string quartets have you written?
I've only written two.
So these are they. These are your two string quartets.
Yes, the two string quartets plus Of Darkness and the Heart, which I suppose can be counted as a third quartet or whatever one wants to call it. Yes, I think writing quartets, of course, is always very daunting to a composer with the great shadow of Beethoven falling over everyone.
Yes. What does one do?
What does one do? So I waited a bit like Brahms till I was 40. and in fact, Andrew Haverin, who performed Raptus, was the person who kind of provided the spark, because he was a leader of the Hogarth Quartet, a young quartet in Britain at the time, and they just won a prize to commission a new quartet. And after the Queen Elizabeth competition, he asked me whether I would be prepared to write one, and I said, I'm willing to do it at last. But yes, writing a string quartet, always daunting. And in fact, in this first string quartet, I avoided entirely writing a sonata form movement, simply again because Beethoven did such wonderful stuff with sonata form. I sort of thought, well, maybe I should just leave that for a later moment.
But that brings me to a point. I see that you are in fact working on a second symphony at the moment, which is called The Four Elements. So the symphony has always been a musical form that I have found most fascinating, especially if it's abstract, if it's not really influenced by paintings or pictures or scenery or poetry. Do you enjoy the discipline of a symphony? You said you waited till 40, like Brahms. But, I mean, there you also have the great Beethoven. Or do you just throw out the sort of sonata form concept?
Look, I wouldn't say made peace with sonata form. I enjoy, turning sonata form upside down and round about and doing all kinds of interesting things to it. So, sonata form is for me, one of those, I would say, almost immortal forms of classical music. I know a lot of people consider it completely outdated and irrelevant, but, I'm not one of those. Yes, I think even in the 20th and 21st centuries, many composers have still engaged with the idea of sonata form and the idea of thematicism, which is again a crucial one in my way of thinking about music. I can't conceive of music as being merely a kind of abstract game of organized sounds. So yes, for me, writing a symphony is very often about that. The symphony that I'm writing at the moment, The Four Elements, again, will tend to steer clear of sonata form, I think mainly because of the way the individual movements are structured and the way the work as a whole is conceived as almost a celebration, if you like, of the elements of music as well, the building blocks of music, rather than the more evolved forms such as sonata form.
You remind me of that magnificent symphony by Carl Nielsen. But I think that's the four temperaments.
The four temperaments,
that's
indeed.
Right, yeah.
Well, I thought we've had the four seasons, we've had the temperaments, it's about time for the elements.
The elements, good. And one of the other things I saw in an interview with you was that you have sometimes been regarded as an anti-modernist. And is that simply the avant-garde, the atonalism that you rejected? Or just tell me a little bit about your having acquired the label of an anti-modernist.
Well, I wouldn't say I'm very much anti anything. I do incorporate certain modernist elements into my work, along with everything else that I like. For me, the voice of a composer is something that is the result of the things that speak to you and which you somehow assimilate and then rework and incorporate in your work. And I suppose in that sense, I'm an eclectic, but yes, it certainly doesn't really include rejecting anything in particular. And yes, many elements of my music, I think, will sound modernist also to listeners. I think I certainly, even as a student, rejected atonality. And for many people, that is the kind of flagship of modernism. So, yes, I just found that atonality tended to generate music that to my ears meanders and doesn't seem to be going anywhere, and I find it rather boring to listen to.
It's very, I almost want to say, encouraging to hear you, a modern composer, as we've heard from your work so far, denying or rejecting atonality as such.
Well, look, I started off as an atonal composer at the age of 16 or so. So I remember the first LP I bought myself was Penderecki's The Devils of Loudun, which is, you know, fairly radically out there. But after having listened to it for three or four times, I actually realized that I didn't ever need to hear it again, because the music functioned at a level where it was instantaneously effective and very dramatic, but it kind of operated at the level of organized sound. And organized sound for me is just one of the many dimensions that are possible in creating music. And if the music doesn't do anything more than that, I lose interest after a while. I think the whole game that one can play, a very complex game with tonal goals and expanded tonality, all those games enrich the musical discourse vastly and make one want to go back and hear it again and discover other things. So it creates layers of meaning which I don't think exist in something which purely means to be organized sound.
Let me quote from your own interview, the one I referred to earlier with Maud Neighbours Aidenhout. You say here, "But I soon realized that atonality was the music equivalent of that mercifully brief moment in modernist poetry when you were allowed to combine any sounds as long as they didn't form words." Quite a controversial but fascinating statement.
Indeed, I think there is a very close parallel. That movement in poetry was very short-lived, simply because, again, people got bored very soon with listening to meaningless sounds. But in music, I suppose meaning is much harder to define, and therefore meaningless sound went a lot further. Mm-hmm. And of course, composers were very serious about replacing tonality with other means of musical organization or sound organization. And I think there were many interesting essays. I think for me, ultimately, all of them are failures, simply because tonality is something we understand instinctually without having to have it explained to us. As soon as the composer has to write two pages to tell me how the piece is put together before I can make head or tail of it, I sort of think, well, you know, is it music in the first place, or is it really an essay in organizing sound? And is the organization itself maybe really ultimately the aim of the piece? Mm-hmm. I regard organized sound as a perfectly valid art form, and perhaps one that runs parallel to music, but not one that replaces music.
Yes, because, and yet again, I must refer to what really was a fascinating interview with Morne Bezadenhout of UCT. He asked you what you would consider the most significant stylistic influences on your music. So I could ask you that, or I could quote you here. May I? And then you can just expand
on
it. Because you said, "There are many characteristics that I admire in the music of others and that I strive to incorporate in my work, but perhaps the two fundamental ones are beauty and expressive intensity." And you then go and list composers right back from Gesualdo Monteverdi right through to Schoenberg, Prokofiev, and Britten as composers who achieve that balance of beauty and expressive intensity. Is this what you strive for? Is this what inspires you most? Is this what you work towards?
Absolutely, yes. I suppose, ultimately, once you get past the snobbishness of the intellectual student that we spoke about earlier, you realize that the music that you return to, the music that you listen to over and over, is the music that is beautiful and expressive. Mm-hmm. Either or is also possible, but usually both. And I suddenly realized, well, if I want other people to listen to my music, then surely I should be writing that kind of music. And that is what I have been aiming to do ever since.
But you have to be a 21st century composer. You can't rewrite the romantics. And this must be the great challenge, so that it's not atonal, or that it's not too dissonant.
Indeed. It's a bit of a tightrope act. Mm. On one hand, you'll always be accused by some people of being too conservative and by others of being too avant-garde.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think it's an exciting balancing act, and I think one which composers of all ages have had to deal with. I always quote that introduction to Mozart's 3 piano concerto, where he says there's something here for the amateur and also something for the connoisseur. And I think, in a way, that puts it in a nutshell. One wants to be accessible to people who know nothing about the theoretical underpinnings of music, and at the same time, you want to put something into your music which is there for, if you like, the more sophisticated a listener. And I think the same really applies when one talks about conservative and avant-garde. I don't want to be too conservative. I don't want to rewrite Schubert's sonatas, much as I love them, but I would be very happy to be the Schubert of the 21st century if that were possible.
Yes.
In other words, to have the same kind of aesthetic ideals, but working with the materials of our time.
You're explaining it very nicely, Hendrik, so thank you. Not leaving us in the in the shade here. But let's have a break while we ponder all that. And now we're going to listen to a piece of piano music by you. Tell me what we're going to hear.
It's a piece called Kalunga from the Partita Africana. It was originally written as a kind of concert etude for the UNISA Transnet International Piano Competition. So again, a very challenging piano piece, performed in this case by a Chinese pianist, Yu Yin, who, to my mind, gave the best performance of the work. She's never been to Africa. In fact, she said she specifically had to go and look at a video of African dancing to find out what this was all about. The piece makes use of quite complex cross rhythms, such as one finds in all kinds of African music, especially perhaps the music of Central Africa. And Kalunga himself is a figure from Nguni mythology, the god of the underworld, who, in this piece at least, does a kind of perpetual dance, never stopping, as he's also the god of death. So, a rather dark and threatening work, and also in musical terms, what we would call a perpetual mobile.
Piano music by my guest, the composer Hendrik Hofmeyr. Remind me, Hendrik, what that was.
The piece is called Kalunga from the Partita Africana, and it was played by Yu Yin, a Chinese pianist in the UNISA Transnet competition.
You know what? One thing I wanted to broach, Hendrik, if you don't mind, is you've had a fairly controversial life politically, because you were a conscientious objector. That's why you went to Italy in the first place, wasn't it?
Indeed.
And, I mean, you've got yourself sort of into trouble with people you call the cultural police here in South Africa, haven't you?
A little bit, yes. I really welcomed the arrival of democracy and freedom in this country, and I thought we'd all finally be allowed to be truly free and, yes, to pursue the interests that were closest to our hearts. But, of course, it's turned out rather differently. And we do have a very strong cultural pressure being exerted from many different sides to establish a kind of South African musical identity, whatever that may be. No one's dared to define it. But, of course, the quick answer is, as the majority is African, it should be African. Now, I'm afraid I simply don't subscribe to that kind of simplistic political maneuvering, or perhaps one can use even stronger terminology, but I won't.
Okay.
And yes, I do find that many people who are sort of in the front line of the chorus calling for this are doing it to further their own careers because they see it as an astute move from a political point of view.
A form of political correctness.
Indeed, indeed.
In gaining a political expediency.
Yes, yes. It's not necessarily that those are their real artistic convictions, but they think those are the convictions that will take them furthest. And I've been quite vocally outspoken against this and have had to pay the price on several occasions.
In the democracy.
Yes. And of course, it was one of the, I think, one of the great pities in the transition to democracy that classical music, perhaps more especially than any other art form, became stigmatized as elitist and Eurocentric and white and all the rest. Just at the time when I would have thought finally this wonderful art form will be accessible to everyone who could want to be interested in it or pursue it or become a practitioner. And I think it's a continuing battle to convince people that classical music has something to offer for everyone, that it's not a form of Western imperialism, that it's practiced by all kinds of people of all kinds of culture and color from across the world. And, that we'd be very much the poorer without it in this
Absolutely.
Country.
And look at our opera company here in Cape Town, for example, which has had a remarkable success in getting young black singers, coloured singers, Indian singers, all sorts of singers from around the country onto the operatic stage.
Indeed, and in a way, it took very little to ignite that spark, the passion for what opera and I think classical music in general has to offer. I think one of the untruths that get circulated quite a lot, you know, is that all musics are equal and therefore we choose the one which is going to get us the furthest politically. And of course, we're not allowed nowadays to talk about art music and popular music even, or highbrow and lowbrow. But ultimately, Western classical music has focused on exploring ways of expression for many hundreds of years and therefore has a huge palette to offer any potential composer in terms of what they can express. I think, as far as I'm concerned, a wider and a larger palette than any other form of music, and I say that advisedly. Very few other musics have focused so exclusively on honing an expressive language through all the possible technical means, and Western classical music has never been exclusive. It's always incorporated elements of other musics and even ways of thinking proper to other musics. So it is, I think, a huge treasure trove for any musician to delve into. And I don't want to take anything away from popular music, but popular music very often is created for commercial gain rather than primarily for artistic aims. And I think classical music is a kind of safe haven in a sense where you are still allowed to create for the sake of the art. Now, I know that sounds very ivory tower, and I'm sure I'm going to be attacked about that again, but that's the way I feel about it.
Well, look, here's another one of your quotes that I really liked and I think is quite potent, because I was going to ask you what you thought the relevance of Western classical music was, and you've answered that spectacularly well. But you've said here that Western classical music has become an easy political target in this country, not because it's a Western import, and you go on to say pop music and soccer, the darlings of political patronage, are that also, but because it is an art form that requires time and effort.
Indeed. It is therefore less immediately accessible than other art forms, and of course it's very easy to go from less accessible to exclusivist or elitist and so forth. And I think that's very, very wrong. Certain art forms take more dedication and more years of study to perfect. But that doesn't mean that they are therefore less valuable to humanity as a whole. I think Western classical music explores realms of the human spirit that no other art form does to the same extent. And I think has something to offer for anyone who is human. So when people talk to me about relevance, I always say, well, if you are human, it's relevant to you. And I don't think, you know, the argument that Bach's music can only be relevant to someone who was born in the 18th century and happened to live in Leipzig in the street, same street block and went to the same church as Bach, I think is so patently absurd that one simply needs to extend that principle to all music and say music does not have to be relevant only to the immediate society in which it was written. And in fact, perhaps the greatest music is the music that transcends that localized relevance.
It's very inspiring and gratifying hearing someone like you, Hendrik Hofmeyr, say that. So thank you for sharing your thoughts with us. Controversial, maybe. True, maybe. All those things. But it's been fascinating talking to you, and I hope we've introduced people to your music and that they'll explore it further. And just before you go, we've got time for a very short piece to end. So what are you going to treat us to?
This is the slow movement from my concerto for flute, violin and strings. In this recording, played by Raffaele Trevisani and Pete Kurnoff with the Moscow Chamber Orchestra.
Okay, Hendrik, thanks, and come back again sometime.
Great pleasure. Thank you.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.
Hi, I'm Alan Committee, and this festive season I'm back at the Theatre on the Bay with a brand new hysterical stand-up comedy show called Laughing Matters. In a world where political events move faster than our Springbok backline, where our sports teams can't outscore the Rand exchange rate, and crime means you get everything at a steal, I would suggest that Laughing Matters. So get your belly full of bubbly barrel loads of comic burble. Buy your tickets now. Alan Committee brings you all the Laughing Matters. Theatre on the Bay from December 6 to January 14.